Yes, I remember everything. I know who I am. I am the Doctor. I am the Doctor.
Listening to Pieces of Eight. It's a Doctor Who podcast that hopefully gives you a bit of a buzz when you hear a new episode has dropped.
Well, the good thing is that it's totally free to listen to as well, so you're not getting stung for it. Yes, we are carrying on our trip through those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith.
And I'm Rebecca Chapman. You join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, forecast audios, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, or anything else we can lay our eyes, ears, and hands upon. And this week, we are featuring our third Eighth Doctor novel from the BBC Books range, which ran from July 1997 until June 2005. Given there were 73 books published in that time, plus one other after the monthly range ended, we've still got a hell of a long way to go.
We most certainly do. So, there's no time like the present, so why don't we crack on with our latest book, Eater of Wasps, by Trevor Baxendale. Now, that is a title that is just absolutely evocative in its own right, isn't it?
The title alone just makes me cringe. Just, ugh, no.
Yeah.
Why would you... No.
No. It's not... I mean, you think of all the health crazes that we have, and I don't think wasps have been any of them. We've had... I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, doing the Bush Tucker trials, and you've been able to buy things like crickets on a stick and that kind of thing, or crickets and lollipops and mealworms and things like that.
I have eaten a worm in a lollipop.
No, was that a tequila worm?
It was not a tequila worm. I was like 12 years old.
Oh.
But it was good. I did enjoy it, weirdly enough.
Interesting, because I don't think I've ever tried anything like that whatsoever, but no.
Yes, I was really young and my mum managed to convince me that it was like a jelly worm.
Oh, it was, rest your soul. The things that you do to play tricks on your kids, yeah. It's fun. It's great fun, that sort of thing. And it's and the cover of it as well, it's just that open mouth with the lips and just wasps in the mouth, all over the lips and just around the mouth. It is just, ooh, there's something... almost quite schlocky horror about it as well. The schlocky horror show.
I was just about to say, it reminds me visually of the beginning of the Rocky Horror Picture Show with the mouth. Terrible.
I hadn't thought about it. I have to say, I'm not a fan of insects in a room, particularly last summer. I was stung by a wasp on the bottom of my foot for the first time in years. I'd taken my shoe off when I was in the park. I was out for a walk, took my shoe off because I had a stone in it. And then literally a wasp, because I sat down beside a bin, and it snuck in and buzzed, and it was absolutely agony. And I haven't had a pain like that in years, and it must have been more than 30 years the last time I was stung by a wasp. So, yuck.
I know when I was a teenager, I was wearing like flip-flops, and a bee got squashed in between my foot and the flip-flop and stung the bottom of my foot. And... I had I was with a friend, and they went and got their mum because we weren't that far from their home. And their mum came back with like half an onion and just like attached the half of an onion to the bottom of my foot. And, I mean, it helped, but I still don't know why.
I have never heard of that before, an onion for a sting.
Just like bizarre. Half an onion on the bottom.
Yeah, but I do think it was a very clever idea of Trevor using wasps, because it... they're not an animal that it's easy to love. Of all the creatures in creation, butterflies, yep, beautiful. Moths even, in their own extent. But no, wasps are just nasty, vicious little buggers, and I really, really hate them. So I'm always quite happy to squish them or chase them out the house when they start to appear.
Yeah.
And yeah, I like animals as a rule. Bees, on the other hand, I will catch and release, but not wasps. Wasps must die.
Bees are pretty cool. You can talk to bees. You can be like, come on, out you get. You do not want to be in here. And they just kind of like hover off. They're great. But wasps, they're just like, I will eat your face. They're awful. Why?
Yuck. Do not like.
Definitely not. as you know, Kenny, I was just 6 years old when this was published. So could you put this book into context? Yes, I know. I'm the young one. You're the old one. Here we go.
Listeners, I'm sticking my middle fingers up.
Of course you are.
My nose.
I'm covering my face. I'm going, na, 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 I can't see you.
Young face.
So anyway, can you put this book into context for those of us who don't know? Who was the Doctor travelling with and what happened to him by this point?
Well, this is sort of slightly after the midway point of the range when this one was released. At this point, the Doctor had been involved in a conflict which had seen Gallifrey destroyed. It wasn't the Time War. And surprise, surprise, Becca, he'd lost his memory.
I'm convinced that this man just needs someone to just like wrap his head in bubble wrap and be like, look, stay there. You are you. Do not move.
Yep, most definitely. Well, he had lost his memory and had been traveling before his before the whole thing. He'd been traveling with Sam Jones initially and then Fitz Kreiner. And then Sam left and they were joined by
Fitz.
Oh, Fitz is great. And then they met the Doctor and Fitz met a woman called Compassion who turned into a TARDIS from the future, and she was a sentient TARDIS. And then Gallifrey was destroyed and the Doctor's memories of everything were gone, and that's where we rejoined him in our previous story, which we featured in the podcast, Escape Velocity, when he got the TARDIS back, when having spent 100 years on Earth recuperating and letting the TARDIS resume itself. So this is set slightly after that. I think this is like 4 books or maybe 3 books after Escape Velocity. So the Doctor and Fitz are traveling with Angie Kapoor. So it's still a fairly new TARDIS team together, but I love them. They're one of my favorite Eighth Doctor time traveling teams, particularly in the books range. So that's where we're up to here.
Perfect. Quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Is Compassion, as a sentient TARDIS, is she sexy?
Well, she's got red hair. So yes, definitely. She's definitely. Are you going with that line that Matt Smith says, oh, you sexy thing? So yes.
I'm sorry, but that episode will forever be imprinted on my brain. That woman in a corset. Oh my God.
Down, girl.
Oh, terrible. Mm-hmm. Anyway, according to the back cover blurb, the TARDIS lands in the sleepy English village of Markling, as calm and peaceful as any other village in the 1930s. Or so it would seem at first glance. But the village is about to get a rude awakening, as the Doctor and his friends discover they aren't the only time travellers in the area. A crack commando team is also prowling the Wiltshire countryside. I'm sorry, but Wiltshire is so beautiful.
It is.
Sorry. Charged with the task of recovering an appallingly dangerous artifact from the far-flung future, and they have orders to destroy the entire area should anything go wrong. And then there are the Wasps. Mutant killers bringing terror and death in equal measure. What is their purpose? How can they be stopped? And who will be their next victim? In the race to stop the horror that has been unleashed, the Doctor must outwit both the temporal hit squad, who wants him out of the way, and the local police, who want him for murder. So, unlike Big Finish stories or Short Trips, we don't have any clips from the story pre-prepared, but, Kenny, I think you've done something for us.
Indeed I have. I've done a short reading from the book, complete with sound design, for the moment when the Doctor and Fitz first encounter Charles Rigby, the titular Eater of Wasps. The Doctor's light flashed from within the kitchen to signal the all clear. He slid the window open a little further and helped Fitz in, who fervently wished that he could duplicate the Doctor's uncannily soundless entry. A moment later, they were both standing in Charles Rigby's kitchen again, every nerve stretched taut in the stillness. It only took a matter of seconds to sweep the torch beams around the kitchen and established that it was empty. Doctor, Fitz whispered, how exactly do you intend to find this thing? I mean, even if it is in the house, it could be anywhere. I suspect it won't be far from Charles Rigby himself, answered the Doctor, in equally hushed tones. Find him, and we stand a good chance of finding the artifact. Fitz's look of horrified disbelief was lost in the shadows, but his strangled bark of doubt was not. Shh, admonished the Doctor sharply, and then again, more quietly,
Shh.
Doctor, I had rather hope not to see Rigby again tonight, if you don't mind. Don't worry, came the reply, with a kind of casual disregard for obvious terrible danger that Fitz had come to distrust completely. There's always this, remember? The doctor was shining his torch into the palm of his other hand, where he held the small black fragment he had found the previous day. In the bright circle of light, it glittered like an emerald. I've a feeling this will help lead us to the rest of it, the doctor whispered. A clock chimed loudly, announcing to the night, in general, that it was 2 o'clock in the morning. When Fitz recovered from the shock and calmed down, he found that the doctor had disappeared. He eventually caught a glimpse of his black velvet coat in the hallway and hurried to catch up. Fitz gradually became aware of a familiar odour, the acidic smell he remembered from his last visit to Rigby's house. It made him feel uncomfortable and nauseous. In here, said the doctor quietly, indicating a door that led, presumably, to the living room. They crept forward, freezing as a floorboard creaked, predictably perhaps, and then pushed the door slowly open. A black void greeted them. The doctor scanned the room with his torch, throwing up a few fleeting impressions. Armchairs, table, fireplace, a cabinet full of chinaware. The shadows jumped and loomed mockingly around the walls. The rank smell was worse in here. Much worse, as though there was something poisonous and vile waiting in the shadows. Fitz gasped when his own torchlight suddenly picked out Charles Rigby's face in the darkness. He was standing there in the middle of the room, as still as a statue. Not even the attention of the torchlight caused him to stir. He was, apparently, asleep standing up. His eyes were shut, and his mouth was open. Something small moved in the beam of light, flitting away to the surrounding gloom. With a jolt, Fitz realised it was a wasp, and there were more of them flying around Rigby's head, flashing briefly as they passed through the light. One wasp flew straight into Rigby's open mouth and he didn't even flinch. Horror-struck, Fitz watched as another wasp joined it. Then he realised that the man's mouth was unnaturally dark in the torchlight, and the darkness was moving. Gradually, he understood. Rigby's mouth was full of wasps. Live wasps. They were flying in and out of Rigby's head like the wasps infesting the plums in his garden yesterday. Fitz was unable to tear his eyes away from the sight, although he desperately wanted to. He desperately wanted to scream as well. Wide-eyed, he watched as a wasp crept out of one of Rigby's nostrils, its antennae waving. Perhaps the most grotesque aspect to this horrible apparition was Rigby's complete immobility. He just stood there, crawling with wasps, utterly oblivious to the presence of the doctor and Fitz in the room. The nightmare vision disappeared as the torch beam veered away. Fitz felt the doctor's cool hand on his, pushing the torch down. Oh, God, doctor, Fitz whispered hoarsely. Ignore them, ordered the doctor firmly. They're ignoring us after all. What are they doing? Fitz felt rather than saw the doctor shrug. Living inside him. What for? That's not what we're here to find out. We're after the artifact, remember? Fitz tightened his grip on his torch. His hands were sweating profusely in the gloves now. Let's get on with it then, shall we?
That sounds horrible, and I'm not just talking about your inability to even try a Cockney accent for Fitz.
I know, it is horrible. I just can't do accents. I tried it and it's like, I'm not even as good as Dick Van Dyke, or Dick Van Dyke even. Yeah. Oh, right, Mary Poppins. Oh, right. I just thought, no.
Oh, blimey, Mary Poppins.
Up the old apples and pears. No, I can do a quite bad Wiltshire accent, but no, I just thought I'm not going to try. What?
Okay, I need to hear your Wiltshire accent. Come on.
Okay, let me think. Let's see. All right, how's it going? You all right there? What are you up to? No, okay, maybe not. See, that's why I don't do accents.
Considering how close I live to Wiltshire, that was awful. That was the worst. My God. Oh. Anyway, that was terrible.
Yeah, like I said, I can't do accents. And yeah, anyway, moving back to the subject at hand, this is one of my favourite BBC Doctor Who novels, and And that's including the previous Doctors, and there's some great ones in there. But for me, this one is up there as one of the greatest. It's got a great story. It's got the Eighth Doctor being slightly darker, slightly more aggressive, which you wouldn't quite expect based on the TV movie. So there's a bit of evolution of the character, and it all sort of makes sense as well. And there's some wonderful, wonderful horrific image set in a location that we can all picture, with that quaint English village with recognisable characters there. But yeah, it's absolutely one of the very best of the BBC books. Trevor created something that's really horrible there, and not just my accent, I created that.
He has, and I think it's time we met Trevor. Unfortunately, I missed this one, again, because I was at work when you recorded it.
Sorry, again.
Yeah, I'm Trevor Baxendale, and I'm the author of Eater of Wasps.
Welcome to Pieces of Eighth, Trevor. It's lovely to have you on.
Thank you, it's very nice to be here.
Do you remember where you were when you heard Paul McGann's casting as the Doctor? And as a fellow Scouser, what did you think of it?
Do you know, I think the first I knew about it was the Doctor Who Monthly. When that arrived, the picture of Paul McGann is the Doctor on the front, taken of him at Longleat, I think, holding a piece of The Key to Time. That is the first I knew of it. Literally the cover of that magazine, yeah. The fact that it was from Liverpool didn't really sort of seem to impact on me much, but I was just too sort of interested in the look of him and who he was and how he was going to be, because it's such a momentous sort of bit of news.
Yeah, it was so bizarre the way it just sort of appeared, whereas you look at it now with the fanfare you'd have with the papers and such like.
Yes, and no social media sort of scuttlebutt going on or rumours or anything, yeah. Yeah, it's a completely alien time now, that, isn't it, to think how news, they could break that as an exclusive. It's mind-boggling.
Incredible. And what do you recall about the first time you saw the TV movie? Did you queue up for a video purchase, or were you waiting?
I absolutely did. I was there at midnight. Yeah, I queued up outside HMV, because it was very, very shortly after the passing of John Pertwee, wasn't it? Because a lot of people were talking about that in the queue. And I was there in the queue, got my copy at the midnight sale. I went straight home and went straight to bed. and the reason for that, I feel a bit guilty about that now, but the reason is because I felt like it was a momentous thing and I wanted to be there at that midnight sort of sale when it opened and get my copy and come home. But I just knew in my heart I was too tired to really enjoy it and appreciate it and sit up there till, you know, 1:30 in the morning, because I'd be watching like that. So I thought, no, I've got it now. I'm satisfied I've done that. I'll watch it tonight. It's exactly what I did.
Yeah, well, I was one of the ones who queued up in Edinburgh at HMV there. And Paul Mars, later to write for the Eighth Doctor in books and audio, was there in the queue as well.
Yeah.
Quite amazing. Wow. I did actually watch it first thing.
Yeah, I really should have done that. But at the time, it just seemed, no, I'll wait and I'll watch it tonight. So that's what I did.
Yeah. So today we're going to be chatting about Eater of Wasps, which was your third Eighth Doctor novel for BBC Books.
Yes.
So hopefully we'll chat about the others in future episodes. But what had you learned about this Doctor by writing for him previously by the time you came to Eater of Wasps?
Well, I was pretty satisfied by the time I came to write Eater that I knew my way around it. The Eighth Doctor, you know, characteristically, his speech patterns and so forth. But what I did when I went, it's the same thing I did for the previous two books, is that I tried largely to ignore the other books that had come out, which I'd read them all anyway. But I went back to the TV movie all the time, because that was always like the genuine 100% Paul McGann as the Doctor source material for me. So whenever I wrote for the Eighth Doctor, I always try to channel that characterization into my book, because that was the only way I felt I was satisfying myself that I was being true to the Eighth Doctor in the one and only time that Paul McGann had played him at that point.
Yeah. How did the whole writing process come about? Was it a case of Justin Richards as the Range editor contacting office for ideas, or was it a case of you approaching him saying, I've got this idea, what do you think, and running with it then?
At the time, it was a bit of both, because I was sending in ideas for books and novels, but I think Justin did come back to me, and there were a couple of slots for that year because, as you know, BBC Books were producing 11 Eighth Doctor books a year at that point. It was one a month. It's just an incredible output when you think about it. Inconceivable now. How would they even fit that in media terms now? That many books a year.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? But anyway, and he said there were a couple of slots available and he was looking for something set in the past. So I sent him a few ideas, one of which was, you know, literally a paragraph, one of which was Eater of Wasps. And he just jumped at that because he said the title just leapt out at him straight away. And also he liked the story idea as well. Seemed to fit in with what he was looking for. So that's how the commission for Eater of Wasps came about. And it's funny because at that point, I always used to find that I generally came up with titles for things first. That's probably I don't know if that's a strange or unusual thing for writers to do, but when you're mulling around or you hear things or a particular phrase pops into your head, and often for me, that's the spark then. That's the thing that leads into what could that be about? And so at that point, that was where it came from. Yeah, Eater of Wasps. I just thought it was an immediately attention-grabbing title for something.
And it's got such a strong cover image as well, and the whole book is just packed with that idea of wasps flying in out of people, in and out the noses and out the mouth, and it's so vivid and graphic, and it's horrific, and it's something we can all imagine because it's so easy to see, given that people tend not to like wasps very much. And did you enjoy making it so vivid and icky?
Yeah, I really did. At that point, I was very into the sort of horror motif for Doctor Who. And also because the book range and Doctor Who as a whole at that time was sort of skewing more towards the older fan, there was a lot more freedom in what we could do and how we could express the sort of grislier side of some of the things the Doctor encountered. So, yeah, I really enjoyed that very much. And it can be a bit of a lazy crutch, I think, for writers, and one that I'm guilty of, because I know I've done it plenty of times before, is that when I'm sort of struggling with a story or something, if you steer it back to something that is a bit more sensational or shocking, it just brings a bit of a sort of spark and a spur to what you're writing about. And that's probably happened quite a lot with something like Eater of Wasps, because it's predicated on that very visceral horror, isn't it? That, as you say, wasps and insects or anything, and that intimacy of them actually being in someone's mouth or inside you, it's a great hook.
I think it's a very visual book as well, in that you've got locations that you can easily imagine. There's obviously some of your other books a bit more science fiction-y, such as the Janus Conjunction, or Janus, depending on how you wish to pronounce it. But in this one, you've got the police box in the English village, sort of that quintessential Doctor Who setting.
Yes, yeah, that was quite unusual for me, and I think it is quite unusual in most of the stuff that I've done for book writing, is that to sort of put it into that sort of milieu of the almost Miss Marple-ish type village, you know, it just adds an extra little sort of layer to that. And also with the future commandos coming back with their own distinct mission, which is sort of, so you've got this three-way story going on really between the Doctor and what he's looking into, the commandos coming back from the future, and the wasp thing as well. So I felt I was sort of like getting into my stride there with writing. Felt to me at the time anyway, like I was bringing in a little bit more complexity to what I was writing for Doctor Who.
Yeah, I think it's just a great setting. And did you need to do much research into it, or did you pretty much go with what you knew? You didn't need to do too much looking back to the 1930s.
No, I pretty much went instinctively with, as I said, because, you know, there's a lot of TV and media set in that time. And I think with the thing with Doctor Who as well is that when you do settings like that, you have to go for that sort of broad strokes characterization of what people expect in a setting, because the dynamic factor, the unusual thing you're bringing in is the Doctor and the aliens and the stories. So you've got to put that in a recognizable situation and backdrop for it to work. The old, you know, Yeti on the loo and Toosing Beck thing, isn't it? You've got to have that standard background in order to bring in the Doctor Who stuff.
The Doctor's got two distinctive companions here in Fitz and Angie. You'd obviously written for Fitz before. So how did you find doing Angie? Did you get an idea as to what she was like from escape velocity or anything like that?
A bit of an idea. And I think the writer's guide for Angie sort of stipulated that she was very much based or similar to someone in one of the TV programs at the time. I can't remember. It was a really popular one, but I didn't watch it. There was a character in that she was likened to. So I was struggling from that point of view to sort of get much of a grip on it, because you didn't have anything like YouTube where you could just click on, like, look at a few scenes or something. So I think I did actually try and watch an episode of what it was, but I found Angie a bit of a vague-ish character. I've probably written her quite generically according to the writer's guide, is that she was a modern young woman, professional, you know, sassy but not aggressive, that type of person. Fitz was much more fun to write for.
Everybody loves Fitz. That's the thing. He's so beloved, even all these years later, despite only being on books, isn't it? And one audio appearance.
Yeah, it's a funny character, because when Fitz was first described to me, I really sort of didn't like the dynamic at all. I didn't know how it was going to work. But once he was introduced and up and running, it was just, it's such an easy character to like, because there's a bit of Fitz in all of us. And it's always easy to have someone who can either undercut a scene with a bit of humour, a bit of irreverence, but at the same time ask those important "what's happening now, Doctor?" or "what do we do now, Doctor?" questions that companions, however they're dressed up, it always leads back to being that sort of point of view character for the reader or the audience.
And of the original characters you created, there's some lovely ones in there. You've got the very recognisable types. You've got the vicar, you've got the meddlesome old woman involved with the church, and the local landed gentry. So did you have any particular favourites amongst them, as well as obviously the time team?
I quite enjoyed Squire Pink. As for the rest of them, they're all a little bit sort of, they are cliched characters for that type of environment in a drama story. And again, it's like shortcutting through to that position where the reader feels comfortable with the scenario, the setting, the scene. You present them with these familiar characters, and so it just makes everything a lot easier to write for. Then you can start bringing in the more outrageous stuff.
Yeah, and there's elements of it, and particularly Fat Boy. I remember, you know, having read the book twice back in the day, having enjoyed it and reread it again, and I still, you know, picked up the book and thought, that's the character for the guy that's got Fat Boy the bomb in it. I mean, just silly things that stick in the mind. So you've definitely achieved something there if you can create memorable names and characters.
Yeah, I can't even remember sort of how it came about with the I remember I had the team there, and I knew that there was going to be a nuclear bomb threat towards the end of the story, because I just thought that was a cool sort of countdown to something to have at the end, just throwing in an extra level of jeopardy and danger for the Doctor, so he's not just contending with the wasp and the wasp creature and what that's doing to the locals, but there's a prospect that the whole village or the whole area could go up in a fireball, just as a sort of cleansing operation from the future. I was very much in mind of the amount of like nuclear testing going on around the world, where they test weaponry and bombs. And I remember seeing something about how many nuclear detonations. Everybody thinks of Hiroshima or Nagasaki, but there's all the other detonations as well, to test detonations, and yet the world goes on. These devices are set off and used, and the world goes on. So I thought, from the point in the distant future, maybe a nuclear strike in the 1930s in the middle of England, it would just be just a blip, a historical footnote to them. And so I thought it was quite a sort of real and pressing threat that I could get for the Doctor to have to tackle with. And I'm not sure at what stage, when I realised that Fatboy was going to be the actual device himself, like he has it inside him. That just seemed to be a sort of one of those happy chances when you're writing, where it's just a light bulb moment almost, like, where am I going to get this bomb from? Oh, well, there he is walking around already.
Love it. Did you have any particular favourite moments, you know, when you think back in the book nowadays?
I think I always come back to the finale, the setup in the church tower, in the loft with the Doctor, Rigby, Fatboy, and the conversation that they're having and that they're going on with. I was just reading a little bit back to myself the other day, just to refresh my memory. And there's that part where they've dealt with the wasp creature, but it's like, never mind that, come on, the countdown for the nuclear bomb's going off, got to defuse the bomb. And it's a very sort of typical cliche James Bond type thing where he's got to withdraw the detonator from inside the bomb, but very, very carefully, you know, so can't afford for his hand to shake or wobble. And there's enough stress in that situation as it is, but then all the wasps are going around and one lands on the back of the Doctor's hand and stings him as he's taking it out, you know. And I just thought, yeah, I was being pretty mean to the Doctor there. I was just piling everything onto him. More and more problems. But it worked, and I was quite pleased with the way that came out. And also, now you mention it, that actual final conversation between the Doctor and the creature, where the Doctor basically persuades him to hand over the crystal, which is what controls the wasps and everything, on the understanding that he'll look after it and make things right. And then when he's got the crystal in his hand, he just lets go and let it drop to the floor of the church, where it shatters into a million pieces, because the only option he had to deal with the creature was to destroy that crystal, which he knew would destroy the creature and Rigby as well. And I was quite keen to get that sort of, that little bit of a hard edge into the Doctor, you know, where we know what the Doctor's like. We know he always tries to do the best that he possibly can in any situation and to save lives. But in this situation, he had no choice. But he had to persuade the monster, the man inside, Rigby, to hand over the crystal. So I'm not sure if that worked as well as I hoped. I think it did. It should be a shock moment when the crystal's handed over and the Doctor just lets it go.
Definitely surprised
me. It is a trick.
So yes, it did work. So when I mentioned recently on Twitter that I was rereading this, there was an awful lot of outpouring of love from my followers for Eater of Wasps. So how do you feel about it now, looking back on it?
Oh, really fondly, because I think that was, in a lot of ways, I don't like to think in terms of like breakthrough books, but that certainly seemed to stimulate the most positive response. It was my third book. Janus Conjunction had been pretty well received, and Cold Heart had been okay, but I knew I could do something that was a little bit more than that, and I was very happy to sort of fall on that idea and this story at exactly that time. And going into it, it was a very easy one to write, to be honest, because it was one of those books where I had a very, very clear idea of what I was doing, where I was going with it, and what was going to happen. I mean, you should have that for all the books you write, but some are just a bit easier than others. Some need a lot of work, but some come very easily. And Eater was one of the ones that came very easily. And so I had a lot of sort of confidence in it, I suppose. So it was really nice for it to be received so well. And it is still thought of quite warmly. And I was blessed, as you say, with that very good cover. Black Sheep were very good at the time because they always used to ask for author input. Did the writer have any sort of suggestions or anything particularly they wanted on the cover? They didn't always go with that, but they always liked to consider. So for practically all my books, I got pretty much what I asked for on the covers, and that was no exception. And looking back at the cover now, I mean, I've got it here with me now, is that I think when they were first coming up with that image, it was just too sort of pan book of horror type imagery. So they've sort of messed with the colours on the mouth and the and so on, and just a little bit of like warping in there, just to like take down the sort of how much on the nose it is, or below the nose, I should say. And I think that helps as well. That it just brings an extra little nightmarish twist to it.
It definitely is. That's fantastic. Trevor, thank you so much for reminiscing about it today and chatting with us on Pieces of Eight.
Thank you. It's been nice to talk about it again.
That bit he mentioned about the doctor tricking the creature into giving him the crystal and then dropping it, I believe we can actually hear that, can't we?
We absolutely can. Don't tell anyone, but I finished work 15 minutes early yesterday as we're speaking, just so I could start on putting the sound design together for this, because when I heard that this was his favourite bit, I thought that really deserves to be given the sound design brought to life treatment. And here it is.
"I'll make a deal with you, Charles," said the Doctor. "If you let me have the device, I'll try to defuse the nuclear bomb."
"The human culture, Freddy, no longer exists,"
spluttered the creature. "All right," said the Doctor levelly, "then I'll speak to whatever it is that he's become. If it's not Rigby, or even the Wasps, then it must be the controlling force behind them, the biopsionic energy field housed in that device from the future."
"I am listening, Doctor."
"Good, good, because we don't have a lot of time. Let me have the device." The creature's antennae waved uncertainly.
"Impossible."
"Don't be silly." The Doctor was edging a little closer, licking dry lips. In the light of the trapdoor, his skin was glistening with perspiration. "The device is damaged. Look, I've got a piece of it here." Slowly, the Doctor held up the broken fragment between his finger and thumb. It glinted a dull green. "The device needs to be whole again," he said. "Then it can function properly. Your transformation will be completed."
"I am complete."
"No, you're not. Look at you, bits bulging out everywhere. You must be in a lot of pain too."
"I will survive."
"I've no doubt, but what as? You're trapped in a hostile environment, struggling to exist, enduring terrible pain, confused, angry, but most of all, without purpose. You've been created by something designed to subvert and kill and destroy, but the enemy isn't here. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time." The creature clicked its mandibles and shook its massive head. "Things can be better for you," the Doctor said, "but the device needs to be repaired. Only then can you be truly complete, free of all the pain and confusion." The creature remained motionless. "Let me have the device," urged the Doctor. "Let me help you." He held out his hand towards the creature. His eyes implored the thing that lived inside it to trust him. Perhaps some last tiny vestige of Charles Rigby might have recognised the earnest look in those calm blue eyes. The monster unfolded a long limb, the tip of it hooked around the dull black shape of the device. Slowly, uncertainly, it extended the limb. The Doctor reached out a little further, nodding gentle encouragement. The creature passed the device across the open space, delicately placing it in the palm of the Doctor's outstretched hand. "Sorry," said the Doctor, and then he let go of the device. It dropped like a stone through the open trapdoor, tumbling end over end towards the floor of the church 100 feet below. When it struck the flagstones, the device shattered into 1,000 tiny pieces, scattering fragments right across the transept. A blaze of crackling green energy leapt from the point of impact and dissipated in an instant, leaving nothing more than a bright, formless residual shape in the eyes of those who were watching. The creature convulsed and roared as the energy field lost focus and died. It twisted with such ferocity that its thick, chitinous hide ruptured in several places. Gelatinous tissue spurted through the cracks as it reared up in massive, dramatic shock. Then, with a blood-curdling screech, the thing toppled forward and plummeted through the floor of the loft, following the device all the way down to the flagstones below. It hit the ground with a thunderous crack, its weight splitting the carapace wide open under the impact. For a moment, the pallid meat inside it writhed, the thick black legs jerking and waving uselessly. Then, with a final croak, it sagged and lay still. The wasps that had fallen with their master, now freed of its control, broke away from the corpse and rose up in a cloud of random flight. With nothing to direct them, the insects flew away towards the nearest exit, instinctively heading for freedom. In the loft space, the doctor slowly closed the fingers of his still outstretched hand.
Thanks to Trevor for taking the time to chat with us on Pieces of Eighth. Lovely fella, Trevor. In fact, he did 3 Eighth Doctor books and 1 Big Finish audio as well, which I don't think you've got to yet. Something Inside, which is further down the arc with Kerris, so I don't think you've got there yet.
No, I haven't. I got waylaid by Torchwood.
They always hold everybody up.
I know, they're awful, aren't they? Always in the way. But yeah, I got distracted by listening to all of the Torchwoods, but I'm nearly done with that, so I will get back to it, do not worry.
Excellent, that's good. Whereabouts are you up to with Torchwood?
Where am I up to with Torchwood? Hang on a minute. Let me open my app and I will tell you. I am currently listening to Sync with Indira Varma and Annette Badland.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
It seems to have the Slovene in them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is rather exciting.
Exactly. What? Oh, I'm just checking, mate. There's not a zip in my head. That was just my bottom. It wasn't my gas exchange.
We just need like a zip sound effect here, Kenny. And then we'll be fine.
No, but then that may be misconstrued as something else, so we'll just leave that out.
That is true. You're not talking about your favourite blonde, are you?
Leave Sheridan alone.
Very true. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. But next time, we're back with a trip into the Short Trips.
Indeed we are. We're going to meet producer Ian Atkins, as I mentioned, bumped into him in Forbidden Planet in London recently by chance, and writer Eddie Robson, as we endure the turn of the screw.
Ah, yes, I really enjoy this. But you haven't mentioned the third person we spoke to for that, a certain Mr. E.G. Cho.
Absolutely, indeed we did. Do you know what? I think I've actually just got the joke in the title. It's because it's about the sonic screwdriver. I have just got that joke. Duh!
How did you... Kenny.
I know. I'll have to mention that next week as to... just how thick I am with that, but there we go. Yes, indeed we did. We did speak to EG as well, and yeah, lovely. So I'm looking forward to hearing everybody chatting together.
Yes, because I'm actually there for all of the interviews.
Woo! So I better go and start editing it now then, shouldn't I?
I mean, you probably should. We're already a day late on this one.
Yeah, that's true. So apologies. Unfortunately, real life has got in the way for both of us this week.
Unfortunately. So, yes.
But yes, well, hopefully... all being well, we will be back to our usual Friday drop for this episode, which will be released on the 18th of March, hopefully, all being well.
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Well, as always, it's been lovely to chat and to see you.
It's been the same for me.
So, I shall let you return to your studying. I shall let you return
studying.
To your... Yeah, it's somewhere between being a student and studying, so it's studying.
Mm-hmm.
Does make sense?
I will crack open another energy drink and... finished my assignment.
Well, I'm going to go and think about Sheridan Smith. What? No, I better not.
On your own.
as I listen to an audiobook, of course.
Oh, of course.
Right, and on that bombshell, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.